Hi everyone, it's Norm Farrar, aka The Beard Guy here, and welcome to another Lunch with Norm, The Rise of the Micro Brands.
Lunch with Norm. Lunch with Norm.
My God. Yep, it's a Halloween episode. I had no idea that was coming up. I heard Kelsey was going to do something, but anyways, thank you for joining us today, and we got a great episode. I'm going to be joined by Amazing at Homes, Amy Wiest, and we're going to be discussing everything you need to know about product development. And specifically, we're going to be talking about how to get started with development, how to find the right manufacturers, and how to make your product unique and stand out. But before we get there, I just wanted to let you know that we're broadcasting to you live on Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And if you're watching a replay, skip ahead. Also, if you're on my Facebook page or on my Facebook profile, you can always head over to my Facebook page, Norm Farrar, aka The Beard Guy, and you can watch the whole episodes there, highlights, and all sorts of other content. So at this point, where are you, son?
Hi everyone.
Oh my God.
Happy Halloween. Yes. Welcome to the show, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the intro. Me and Hayden, we planned that out. Oh, it looks like we got Simon in here. Hello, Simon. Happy Friday.
Hey, Simon.
So yes, follow us on social media. We are Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Just search Lunch with Norm or Norm Farrar and you should be able to find us. And we can find us on our podcast. So Apple, Spotify, anywhere you listen to your podcast, you can find us. And let's see, we have a brand new Facebook group. You can search up Lunch with Norm, Amazon FBA and e-commerce collective. It's brand new. It started about 3 weeks ago and we're just starting to get members and get some discussions going. So it's all very exciting. So please, you can head on over. I'll put the link in the comment section here. And yeah, so if you're watching right now, like and share this and let us know where you're from. Oh, and smash that like button.
Smash in.
And ring that bell.
Ring that bell. Ring the bell. So, yep, if you like it, ring the bell. Or I got that mixed up.
That's right.
Like button and ring that bell. That's what you tell me to do all the time. Okay. All right. So we get that straight. If you have any other questions or if you do have comments during the episode, just put them over in the comment section and we will definitely get to them. If we can't get to them because of time, we will be answering them after the podcast. So sit back, relax, grab a cup of coffee and enjoy the show.
Oh, and right. Simon, the pumpkin juice is for after the show. So.
Oh, Kelsey.
Goodness.
How are you, Amy?
I'm good. It's great to be here. You know, I had lunch already. So I saw that picture in the back of your Lunch with Norm ad, and it really inspired me. So I had orange chicken today for lunch.
Ooh, there we go. Nice.
It looks so good.
Oh, so, and that's something, I mean, that was really cool. Kelsey came up with the idea now of these templates. Like if you go to the group or if you go to YouTube and you'll see different lunch items. So I thought that was kind of a cool idea. So I don't give them a lot of comment or compliments, but there's one. There you go, Kels. But anyway, how are you?
I'm really good. I'm really good. It's been a crazy 2020, but yes. I wouldn't change it. Well, I would change COVID because I haven't been able to go to China like I normally do and do all the traveling and everything. But other than that, there's been a lot of really cool things that have come out of COVID and have happened in 2020. So yeah, I'm stoked about it. What about you, Norm? How are you doing?
I'm going crazy 2020. 2020 has been the absolute, well, the best of times and the worst of times. So not going to events has allowed me to concentrate on stuff like this, a podcast, and, you know, kind of concentrate more on social media. It's also allowed me to, you know, have the family at home for 3 or 4 months, which was kind of cool. So it was great. But at the same time, you know, COVID itself, and then just not being able to go out and what I love doing is just, you know, meeting people and going to events, learning things, but also, you know, increasing the network and networking. Yeah. But that part kind of sucks, you know, sitting here and watching my travel points dwindle. I really do hope, you know, that like Delta or, you know, whoever honors the travel point. I can't get out of Canada.
Really?
Do you I can't go to the U.S. to do anything. I don't know if I want to, but you know, I'm an old guy. But yeah, I'm not traveling at all. So yeah, these travel points get just absorbed. But anyways, I hope I keep my status and I just don't start over again. We'll see. But hey, for people who don't know you, can you give us a little bit of background?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am a wife, a mom, an inventor, an entrepreneur. I've been selling on Amazon since 2007. So for a little while. Wow. And but that was just a hobby while I was in the military. I just used to flip my textbooks and stuff like that. And then in 2017, I came up with an idea to invent a new version of a litter box cleaner for cats and well, for humans, not really for cats, because they sure don't clean their own litter box, and that's a problem. but you know, I came up with a better solution for humans, and even though I have a whole bunch of business degrees and stuff, I had no idea how to invent something from scratch. So I went on this journey, and I shared along the way, and started helping other people develop products. And before I knew it, I had a couple of private label brands and Amazing at Home, my consulting firm for e-commerce businesses, was born. So that's kind of the story of it, and long and short. And I live in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, okay. Hey, I'm just looking at some of the comments that are coming in. And Victor says that the pictures are pixelating. It's looking perfect on my end and from your end, Amy. Can anybody else verify if they're getting pixelated video?
Yeah, I think your video screen is pixelating. I'm not sure about mine. Yeah. Like Amy's looks good. But yeah, I'm not sure if the internet connection is over there.
It's weird because his audio is clear. His audio is clear, but his video is pixelated. So
that's so weird.
It might be a camera setting.
And they were saying there is some echo, but I'm not sure if that's a mic issue or Amy, you're using earphones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. I'm not sure, but
okay. I hear a little bit of an echo with Amy. Nothing too bad, but anyways, I have no idea what's happening with the pixelation, because I'm looking at my screen and it looks perfect, 100%. Not that I'm perfect, but the picture looks good. Anyways, let's continue on. And if it gets to be bothersome, let me know, and I might just go on to audio. Okay. But also at this time, I'm looking at all of these people. Simon, thank you for joining us. And Giz, you always get me with Giz, Victor. But, you know, welcome back, Victor and Golem. Nice to see you. Hope everything is good with you. I haven't seen you in a long time. He's part of our ASM Toronto group. And we have, oh my gosh, Oksana. How are you? Anyways, all the way from Prague. Nice to see you. And I hope we can meet. Actually, I hope we can meet everybody one of these days again. But anyways, going back to Amy. I hope we don't get too pixelated here. Anyways, let's talk product development. That's what everybody's here for. And I know your product. And I know that one of the things for Amazon sellers is to try to differentiate themselves from anything else that your competitors have. And a lot of people really don't ask their manufacturers, or they don't go ahead and do it because they might think it's too expensive. But what you've done, I really like to kind of go through that process. And first of all, you know, how do you know, or how do you get to that point? So product research, what is your process of trying to find a product that's worth digging into and creating the product development side?
Yeah, well, and this is really hard for people because, you know, not only have I developed a few of my own products, I'm on 3 patents now and many different products that I've developed, but I've also helped, you know, hundreds of other sellers develop their own products, take their products from conceptualization all the way into launch. And the biggest thing is I see, and even in inventors, in the inventor circles, people will move forward with patenting something that might not be marketable or might not be competitive. So for example, maybe you come up with a really cool idea to improve a product, but maybe you have to overdevelop it too much, and the reasonable alternative. So if I add lights and a heating element to this coffee cup, you know, or this water bottle here, the customer may not be willing to pay as much as I have to pay to develop that product, and as much as I have to charge for it. There might not be enough perceived value. So even if you have a good idea, you need to make sure that it's marketable. And you need to make sure that the reasonable alternatives on the market are not, that the customers aren't going to choose those reasonable alternatives over yours. And even if you come to market with a similar product, but you try to improve it, you want to come in at a very competitive price point and make it easy for customers to choose yours. So if I'm going to improve this water bottle here, and I'm going to, you know, maybe add a handle and maybe some lights or whatever, you know, a mirror. we were checking in our phones before the episode here. But whatever I'm going to do with this, right? I'm going to want to make sure that I can offer it competitively and make it easy for the customer to decide, like, oh, this is $20 and this is $20. This one has a handle. This one doesn't. Which one am I going to choose, right? Where I see people make big mistakes is they'll overdevelop a product. You always want to go to market first with a minimum viable product, but they'll overdevelop a product. And then they say, Amy, I hope that I can sell this product for $60. And we look at everybody on page one, and everyone on page one is, you know, $15 to $20. And that's really hard when your brand is not Nike to, you know, charge that much. You're just getting started. So that, I would say, is the first thing that you want to look at. You always have competition, even though, for example, I created a new category in making a litter box cleaner, and that requires education of the customer. I still have competition. Litter boxes are my competition. Scoops are my competition, you know, so I still have competition. So you don't want to think, oh, I never have competition, because there's always something else that the customer can buy. And so the key norm is knowing why people buy the products that they buy. So if I'm thinking about developing a certain type of product, a dog toy or, you know, a consumer good, I need to ask myself, why do people buy that? What problem is it solving for them? And is my new offering giving them something that they don't already have?
Okay, I'm just seeing Victor came back with something. You also have to be careful about... Oh, okay, I thought you were going to talk about my pixelation again, Victor. Okay, what's that question?
You also have to be careful about crossing a price threshold. There's a big perceptive difference between $29.95 and $30.95.
Right. That's a great point.
Oh, and just before we move on from that, Maureen is asking, how can I become a part of the ASM Toronto group?
Okay, so that's real simple. Anybody who's in the Ontario area or in Toronto, you can just private message me and I'll get you the information. There's a private Facebook group called ASM Toronto, ASM Toronto Mastermind. And we've got there's probably about 100+ members there. We're not meeting that often, but we're doing some more virtual stuff. Usually we meet usually when it's going, it's every other month we get together. But anyways, anybody interested, just let me know. I also see that Elchin came on as well. I got a question for you, Amy.
Sure.
You talked about stages. So product development can be costly, and we'll get into that in a sec. But when you're working with your team, do you plan it out that this is where I want to be? This is where we're starting off? So it doesn't cost you $20,000 each time you create something.
Well, it depends, of course, on the product as far as how much it's going to cost you. But, you know, in terms of like, because if you have a large product, a mold might cost more. If a mold is required, you know, that kind of thing. Contracts, patents, all of those things are considerations. But what I encourage people in my mastermind group and in my concept to launch program to do is to always start with the simplest form of their product. And we call this a minimum viable product. And this an MVP, right? Eric Rice wrote a book called The Lean Startup, and he talks extensively about this. And the idea is to get feedback. You don't want to start with, you know, making this product so crazy, right? If you can just start with, you know, the simplest form of that product and try and test the market, right? Even if it's not the exact product, not exactly what you want to end up with when you finish developing, if you can start with something small that kind of leads in that direction and cost you less to kind of test and get market feedback, that's always a really great way to do it. Now, another thing, before you actually start developing the product, you can always make mock-ups. You can get a 3D mock-up done and you can do surveys. There's so many great ways to get feedback on a product before you even start developing it. And a lot of people get scared about that because they're like, well, is somebody going to steal my idea? Well, you can always file a provisional patent on your idea that buys you a year in patent pending status. And that can allow you then to kind of put it out there and share it. And another thing that I love to do is just create a picture of the product. You could have somebody Photoshop it, right? If I'm going to add lights and a heater to this water bottle, I could have someone Photoshop a water bottle with lights and a heater in it, right? And make it look that, turn it into a little infographic. And then I can go out there and do some, ask for some opinions on it. Ask people, what do you think of it? How much would you pay for it? You know, there's so many ways to do that. You can use Amazon's Mechanical Turk and reach out and get lots of opinions for pennies. Google search.
For people who don't know about what you were just talking about, what is Amazon Turk?
Well, Mechanical Turk, Amazon's Mechanical Turk, is a platform where people can get small tasks done, right? They can have people look at their website, or they can, you know, there's many different little tasks that can be done. And there's all these Turkers.
Not twerkers.
Okay. Turkers. But there's all these people who are active members of Amazon's Mechanical Turk, and they enter their information in. So if you need a pool of specific buyers, right? If you need a pool of people that are interested in certain things, you're developing a camping product, right? Well, you can sort by those profiles and say, you know, these are the ones that are able to answer my survey or answer my questions. You can do similar things on platforms like PicFoo. They have lots of consumers that can answer questions. So you could put your main competitor's photo of their product up there, and then you could put your mock-up next to it and say, what do you think about this? How much would you pay for it? Which one would you choose? That kind of thing. And it can really help you make some informed decisions before you even get into, you know, really expensive patents or developing a mold or something like that.
So three platforms that I know about is the one that you were just talking about. You just talked about PicFu. And the other one that I don't know if you've ever used them, but Usability Hub. That's also another great platform for split testing.
I haven't used Usability Hub. Oh, I've used Google Surveys and then Nielsen has a lot of really great product data as well that you can consumer data that you can pull from, you know, previous surveys and stuff that they've done, which is really helpful. But yeah, Usability Hub. I haven't heard of that one yet. Yeah. Try it out.
I'll send you over the info on that. Yeah, it's great. And it's what you can do is really narrow down the demographic. So, you know, if I'm looking for somebody in Toronto, actually, but, you know, usually it goes by country and you're looking for female at a certain age. I mean, it'll just give you exactly what you're looking for in about 5 minutes. So, yeah, it's a great little platform. It can get a little costly depending on what you're doing, but they have lots of different options. But PicFu is awesome. You know, I love their platform as well. One of the other things I was wondering about, would you put like a product, Kirsten Ross was on a little while ago, and she's talking about innovative products for Amazon and doing the whole Kickstarter, you know, crowdfunding. Is that something to see if people would be interested in going forward with your product for cat litter? Would that be something that you would do? You know,
I did. Yeah. Did you? I did. Yeah. I got, I had 60 pre-orders before I launched, which was really nice. The thing that people don't realize about Kickstarter or GoFundMe or any of those platforms though, is it really does require marketing. You do need to plan for it and really spread the word. It's not, a lot of times people think, oh wow, this company, they put this idea on Kickstarter and they raised $2 million, you know, and there might be a perception that you can just throw a product on Kickstarter and you're going to get all these signups and it's just going to be completely amazing. Right. But Kickstarter, GoFundMe, whatever platform you use, Indiegogo, I think is the other one. Mm-hmm. You just need to make sure that you're preparing for that because you're going to need to have a list of people, whether it starts with friends and family and you're asking them to share, but you're going to need to have a list of people that you can reach out to get the buzz going and get some donations coming in. On Kickstarter, if you don't meet your fundraising goals, it's a problem. So yeah. I love those platforms. I think they're really great because people like to peruse them. People like to check out cool, new, innovative ideas. And it's a great way to get some feedback and some backing before you begin. But if you didn't prepare and you put your product out there on Kickstarter and it didn't do well, it doesn't mean that it still couldn't be a smash hit in the marketplace.
Hey, you brought up a good point about the marketing side. So if it's an innovative product, probably the more innovative it is, the more marketing dollars you have to put aside because you've got to convince people that this is going to solve some sort of pain point for them or, you know, that they've got to buy this product. And if it's a cat litter box and it's a, you know, how is yours that much different? And what problems is it going to solve? Sometimes people don't realize that they do have to put a little bit of extra marketing dollars into it, and especially on Amazon. So let's go through it. So you've got your demographic. You've done your research. You might have researched on Amazon or on Google.
Norm, I actually disagree with you about the marketing dollars.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Can I talk about that for a second?
Yeah, let's go for it.
So the thing is, yes, of course, if you have a unique product, you are going to have to tell people. Sometimes products require education, right? They require education, especially if it's completely new, never seen before. But by the time you bring that product to market, you should have already done the market research and know that you're solving a problem that actually exists for people. Right? You don't want to, I've seen people move through and develop products that don't actually solve problems and people would rather buy the reasonable alternative. So one example is the guy on Shark Tank who came in with the camera block, you know, and he was like, I've solved this. It's a cybersecurity problem. And the shark is like, I use a piece of paper, right? So you know, it's and he still sold some of those, and those became really popular swag gifts, you know, so it doesn't mean failure. But the bottom line is, for example, I developed a product that there's no category for. There's no such thing as a litter box cleaner. There is now, but there wasn't when I created this product. But guess what? What major keyword do people search for on Amazon? Litter box. It's right in my title. So, you know, all I did was put no more scooping, litter box cleaner, reuse the litter over and over again, you know? And so I'm already identifying their problems. And the cool thing about unique products that solve problems is they just sell. There's not a lot of advertising required, because when somebody searches for litter box and or odor control or something like that, and I'm ranked for those keywords, they see my product and they see all the reviews and they're like, oh, wow, okay, this is solving a problem for me. And people spread the word about products that work great. So it doesn't require a lot of marketing dollars, because you get excited when you find a cool new product that nobody else has and you want to tell other people about it. It can become so viral and so awesome. I spend almost no money on marketing. It's really, really incredible. It's a lot of word of mouth. So of the people that I've helped develop unique products, when we put them out there, they just sell. People are excited to leave reviews about them. You don't have to like do all of these giveaways and everything like that. They're excited to pay full price for something that solves their problem. And the marketing dollars, as I mentioned, they're a lot lower than if you're selling a product that's just like everybody else's and you have to do a lot more convincing, where I have something nobody else has that solves a problem for people. Doesn't require a lot of marketing other than getting them to the product page, which is easy to do as long as you're using a keyword that is highly searched for.
Yeah, I like your method of, hey, if people are going to be looking for litter box, you're already there. So that's great. And I think that works. I'm looking more at on Facebook or YouTube, or trying to get a lot more external traffic coming over. If people aren't looking what they're looking for, or your competitors, like going over to a company that has cat products, maybe not even a cat litter box, building up or working with their top engagers, or, you know, possibly people in the niche that's interested in cats and targeting litter box. When that comes into their mailbox, or if that comes as a video, if they're searching that on YouTube, you've got to show how yours is different, because they don't see it on Amazon. So I guess what you're talking about is 100%. If you're already ranking for keywords and you're different on Amazon, and you can show that, even if you have a video on your listing, I mean, that's great. But when you're looking at the other, let's say, social media channels, and people don't know about it on Amazon, or they're not looking for it, maybe they're used to a different brand. Now, cat litter box might not be exactly what I'm talking about,
it's so much easier actually for external traffic as well, because it's easier to get an influencer excited about talking about a new and different product. If you come to an influencer and you're like, yeah, I'm selling these water bottles, will you back me? But if you come to an influencer and you came out with a new version of a fitness water bottle that specifically mm-hmm. is after their target audience, they're going to be excited to be the one to back that. And it's so much easier when it comes to external traffic, when it comes to on Amazon traffic, to rank a product like this, for a product like this to go viral, for you to spread the word, and for you to get in sales channels beyond Amazon. It's really, really cool, because you have something that nobody else has. I can sell my products for higher wholesale prices than my partners and my competitors selling commodities. And right. It's a really cool thing, because you have something that nobody else has and that people get excited about. It naturally goes viral. There's a lot more organic potential than, you know, having to run ads for things. And then when you do have a video or something like that that shows how your product works, people get excited, because you can use those call to action and say, this is something that you've never seen before. it's cool, and it's going to solve your problem. And people really tune into that. It's just like the stuff that goes along with Kickstarter. That's why we go on Kickstarter and check out new products, because we want to see the new things we've never seen before.
So going back to Kickstarter for a second, you were talking about provisional patents. What kind of price range would somebody be looking at?
Well, it completely depends, right? You have an, I'm not an attorney, and I would highly recommend people do that. Disclaimer. Yeah. I'm not giving legal advice here, but I have helped a lot of people in this domain, right? With patents and stuff. I'm on my state inventors board. I help inventors all the time, but the bottom line is when it comes to patents, you want to decide how to protect your product. Right? Whether it's you're just going to trademark your brand, right? Whether it's a unique design that you put on something. We had a guy come and talk in our inventors group last month, and he is an inventor of puzzles with unique digital designs on them. And so his designs are going to be protected by copyrights, which is a little bit easier than having to do a full patent, right? And then you have design patents, you have utility patents. Utility patents protect the use of something, and they take a really long time to get. And if your product is very novel, meaning it can very easily be created with two other products, right? It's harder to get a utility patent for it. If it is really kind of complex or new or never seen before, it's easier because you can make more claims. It takes more parts and pieces of different products or different things to put together to make that patent. A design patent is something that protects the way something looks, the design of something. And so a lot of people tend to do that, right? If you're just making a design improvement on something like the water bottle, of course, this is always my example because it's right here. But if you're just doing something like that, a design patent could be the way to go. Now, when we're talking about cost, people always get scared about this, right? Remember, the key is negotiation. You can always negotiate with your, everything in business is negotiable. So when I started with my utility patent, I knew it was going to be expensive. That really kind of terrified me, honestly. I put it into my business plan about what my cost of my molds were going to be, what my startup costs were going to be, the cost to start to trademark my brands and do all of that, right? But I also looked into legal costs. And what I did is I went on upcounsel.com and I put in a job and I said, like, this is my budget. This is what I want. And I interviewed three different attorneys, and the attorney that I ended up hiring, and he was willing to meet my budget for my product. He had worked in pharmaceuticals for over 20 years. So he was so good at combing through everything and making sure that it was patentable. And he did an excellent job. But anyway, long story short, I have spent about $3,000 on a utility patent, getting it completely done.
That's a great price.
Yeah. And because I negotiated and, you know, so, and the other thing is the amount of work that you do too. The more you know about your product, the more that you have your drawings and everything like that done, the more research that you do on patents. The other thing, the other cool thing, Norm, is there are patent agents out there. A patent agent, the only difference between a patent agent and a patent attorney is one has not gone to law school, but they both have extensively studied the patent process. So you can use a patent agent for doing your patent for you. And then you can use a lawyer, a more expensive lawyer if you actually need to fight that patent in court or something like that. Right. So those are some different things you can do. People always think, oh no, it's $100,000. I don't want to patent something. And that's just not the case. Remember, everything's negotiable. There's many different ways to do it. And the USPTO actually has a self-help inventors program that is quite good. And you can call them up. I just filed a design patent last month on my new product that's coming out soon. And they sat down with me the whole step of the way and really like walked me through everything and made sure that everything was good. So there's lots of programs and things that you can do. Don't let that stop you from getting your idea to the market.
Okay, very good. And I just saw something about what Victor was saying. Whether it's worth it or not. And depending on what it is, like for provisional patents, very, very inexpensive. Like for us, we've got a process that we're doing, and we just want to make sure that we can say patent pending, legally say patent pending. It makes sense for us to do that. Sometimes it might not make sense for you to, you know, to do it. We just want to protect ourselves as much as possible. But Amy, you got a great price for a utility patent. You know, usually they're a bit more expensive. What was the name of that website again? I know there's others like it. Up Council. I got to check that out. And we'll post that in the notes as well. So the other scary part about doing something, like having this great idea, are the molds. Mm. How do you, first of all, the mold price is like asking somebody how long is a piece of string, right? I mean, it could be anything, but you want to protect yourself. Do you have any advice for people? How do you protect yourself against a manufacturer taking your item in China and now you're no longer the owner? You see it on Amazon come up and those are your molds, and people are absolutely scared. They're scared about, you know, waking up one day and that's happening.
Yes. Okay. So before I get into that, I just want to remind you guys, and I know Norm would say the same thing. I've had him in my program talking about, sourcing and protecting yourself and everything. But I want to remind you guys that it is your job to know your product. In my course, I actually go in depth on manufacturing processes, because if you don't know your product, that manufacturer is going to know that you don't know your product and they're going to take advantage of you. It's your job to understand how your product could be made, the manufacturing processes, the materials that need to be used. You should have prototyped your product idea and got it to a pretty good place before you go and start talking to manufacturers. You should know how similar products like yours are made. There's a ton of YouTube videos, how it's made, all that kind of stuff. That's always the homework in our manufacturing class. You know, you really need to understand it, because how are you supposed to talk to a manufacturer about making your product if you don't understand the components of your product, how it's made, the manufacturing processes, your target price that you're going after, what you can sell it for, what your margins are? You need to know all of that before you move into finding a manufacturer. So then we get into mold prices, right? So I actually, my first time before I started taking trips to China, I had my molds made. I went to a US-based liaison. And I went, and they went to China and had my molds made for me. And the price on my molds would scare most people. It was, paid $60,000 for my molds. And this was a rather large mold. And then we put it on a ship and it came back from China. And my product is actually made in the USA at a facility in Dallas, Texas. So the thing is, you can have your products made in the USA. In some cases, for me, I made one of my products in the USA. The rest of them are made in China, and I visited all my factories. I have relationships with my factories. So anyway, the bottom line is, know your product. That's step one. Know your specs, right? Know everything about your product. Then go out and start researching manufacturers. Now, before you actually source that product, before you start talking to a manufacturer about your new water bottle with lights and a heater, right? Before you start talking to them about it, I want you to do what's called sourcing a decoy. I want you to talk to a manufacturer that makes similar water bottles, right? And maybe they have something cool on one of them. And I want you to pick something else. So for example, maybe you're going to pick, like, you're going to talk to the coffee mug manufacturer that already has the heater built in, right? And they don't know that you want to add lights to that. That's fine. But you're going to talk to them about different things you could do. So basically, you're not giving up any information about your idea yet. You're sourcing a decoy. You're talking, the conversations you're having with a supplier before you enter into any contracts with them are about a decoy. And then when you know that they're the supplier for you, you know that they can meet your pricing for a very similar product. You know that they can differentiate and that they're the ones doing the manufacturing. And you've asked them about molds and all of that. And you have that information. That's when you enter into your contracts. So I have a Chinese attorney and he draws up my contracts for me. So he negotiates. I use an NNN agreement, which is a non-compete, non-repudiation, non-circumvention agreement. And it's in English and Chinese. And that's what initially protects my idea before I send over those, my designs, right? To talk about, hey, can you make the mold for this, right? But initially I have my Chinese attorney draw up that agreement and he delivers that to them. It's drawn up by law in China. Anywhere you source from, whether it's India, China, Vietnam, whatever, the US, you should be following their legal protocols. You're not gonna protect yourself if you just have like a contract that you made up in English and they don't even understand it, right? And it, you know, they can basically sign it any which way. And that's the other thing that I have my attorney check for me is when they sign it, in China, it has to be signed. It has to be stamped with a red seal. And that stamp is in Chinese, right? So if they're stamping it with another company, like their import export company, I've had suppliers do that to me before. And my attorney looked at me, he was like, that's not the same. They didn't stamp it with the same company that actually that you're sourcing from. So again, I enter into those contracts first before I release any designs or anything to them. And right. Before I enter into contracts, I have those conversations. I make sure they're a good fit for me, right? I make sure they're the right supplier. They can grow with me. I have 7 steps to vetting all my suppliers. You know, I make sure they are who they say they are and that they're a good partner for me by sourcing a decoy. Then I have contracts with them. I also trademark in China because, and actually this is interesting because your competitors, if China's a first to file country. So if your competitors file your trademark in China before you, they can actually prevent your products from being exported. You'll need their permission to export your own products. So it's not actually the Chinese that are doing so much of the trademark stealing. It's a lot of competitors, which is really interesting to find that out. There is some stuff going on in China with that as well, where suppliers are filing for your trademark. So that's why it's important to build those relationships, vet your suppliers, and make sure that you have the right kind of contracts from the start to protect yourself, protect you and them.
Great information. Kelsey, do we have any questions, comments?
Yeah, so there was a couple. We kind of touched on them a little bit already, but I'll go through them again. From Dr. Kaz, what actions do you undertake to prevent your manufacturer from selling your uniquely developed product?
Yeah, okay, and that. Yeah. Talked about contracts, yep.
Yep. And then
And Simon, the most important thing about that is English and Chinese too.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have a course? I don't have affiliate fees or anything like that. So in your course, do you have templates in any of these for any of these contracts?
Yeah, I actually just uploaded them today because all my course members are like, Amy, can we just get some? I'm careful about that because I really want them to use an attorney because I've had suppliers sign it incorrectly, put the wrong company names on there, all that stuff. You know, so I don't want them to just take a template and it's good for them to be familiar with the template, but I don't want them to just blanket use a template and go, oh yeah, the supplier signed it. And then it's no good because it's, right. You know, incorrect.
From Simon, a new product or invention can't be in the public domain before your patent is. Is that why you apply for patent pending?
Exactly, Si. Yep.
Okay. And it's like Simon says, it took me 6 years to get my trademark back in China. okay, from Elton, what is the cost of filling a trademark in China generally?
It's usually between $300 to $600, depending on who you use. And yeah, I think that's right. Right, Norm?
Yeah, it's in and around there. And it depends on how many classes that you're doing. And yeah,
Their class system is really different from ours. They have a lot more class. They have a lot more classes than we do. So it's like, oh my gosh, why do I need 30 classes?
But that's why you would go and use an attorney, like you said. So
yeah,
so you can do. And some people, like if you're really trying to protect your product, they might come back and they might say there's 6 classes or more. I would just spend the money and make sure that it happens. And usually if you're getting additional classes, it drives the price down too for the additional classes.
It also helps just in general. So in the beginning, before you're ready, when you've got your patent in the US, you can also patent in China. There is a lot of US-based inventors who are patenting in China because our USPTO system is actually not as thorough and protectable as China's patent system is. So a lot of US-based inventors are patenting in China, which is really interesting. There's a movie on Netflix called Invalidated. Check it out. It's the story of why people are doing this and what's happening with the USPTO system. But anyway, that being said, just keep in mind that wherever you're doing legal stuff, right? So if you're wherever you're importing and exporting, if you're selling in the US and the UK, you need to be trademarked in the US and the UK. And if you're getting your products from China to sell in the US and the UK, you need to trademark in China, the US and the UK. So wherever you're exporting from and importing to, you need to be protected in those countries. So you should also patent wherever you're selling. You should patent in, for example, I just filed my worldwide patent because I wanted to be able to reserve the time to be able to sell worldwide. I'm expanding now into other countries. So you want to look at all of those aspects and protect yourself wherever you're exporting and importing to.
Perfect. And it makes perfect sense to spend the money if it's going to protect you and make you money.
Exactly. Yeah. and protect you from other people that could potentially patent that same thing. And now whoa, what the heck? I lost my ability to sell my own product in another country simply because I didn't patent there.
Right. So Kels, any more?
Yeah. One just came in. Do you have any recommended attorney for trademarking in China and for the NNN agreement?
So I don't give my attorney's name just because I reserve that for folks that have been trained through me, right? But what I can tell you, Elchin, is to ask your attorney for a referral. That's the best way to find an attorney in another country is ask an attorney that you're familiar with for a referral for an attorney in another country.
Yeah, and you can also contact Alpha Lobby over at Honu. Honu's got some legal team over in China as well, if you're interested. So you can check that out.
If it's patented, sorry, I can't hear China, you. Kels. If it's patented in China, does it hold legal value everywhere else?
Nope.
China.
It holds legal value in China, right? So yeah, you definitely want to make sure that again that you're patenting where you're exporting from and where you're importing to. Now, I understand that you might wait to patent in China until such time that, you've made a little money and stuff like that. You might wait to patent other places, but at a minimum, at least trademark your brand so that you don't have any exporting problems.
Great. Is that the last question?
Yep, that's it for now.
Okay, so now that we've got all that information, how do you go about, what's your process in finding a manufacturer?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to find a manufacturer. Of course, you can go on Alibaba. The hard part about Alibaba is that, or 1688, but the hard part about Alibaba and 1688 is that you get a lot of third parties. You don't always know that it's really a factory. I have a friend in China who helps me with a lot of stuff, and he has a friend that he says, Amy, he's a 10-year gold supplier factory on Alibaba, and it's just a guy in his apartment sourcing. So the thing is, like, you on Alibaba, you really don't know, which is why it's okay to search Alibaba for suppliers, because there's good suppliers in there as well, right? But you just need to make sure that whenever you're looking into a supplier, that you actually vet that supplier. Take time to do a factory audit. Take time to find out, like, do a domain search on who is, and see, you know, look at their business license. Check it out. Make sure that they're registered where they're supposed to be registered. I was on a negotiation call with a client last night with one of his factories in China, and I kept asking information. You know, I always start the conversation with, okay, what are your primary export markets? Tell me more about your factory. You know, how long have you been in business? Because these are things that I'm going to check up on. And I kept asking to talk to the boss. I always negotiate with the boss, because, you know, a sales rep is not going to be able to give you proper pricing or proper information, and they're not going to be able to break anything down for you, and for you to be able to figure out if that's a good partner for you long term. And so last night, you know, we were on this call, and he had arranged this call with the sales rep that he was working with for a long time. And so I get on the call, and of course they can't answer any of my questions really, other than just general information. And they're like, well, we have to ask the boss. And I said, okay, well, next time I want to talk to the boss. Well, anyway, this morning he got an email from them that basically was them saying, like, oh yeah, sorry, the company that you're asking about, they're actually, we actually, that's our Hong Kong company. It's not our China company. And, you know, they went on this whole thing based on the questions that I was asking, because they knew I was going to go check them out. Based, you know, so this morning he got basically a confession in his email box, you know. So the bottom line is, no matter where you find your supplier, you always want to vet them. You always want to take the time to make sure they are who they say they are. You know, even something as simple as having an inspection company go and do a factory audit. There is so many times when those inspection companies go to the address and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Again, remember the guy in his apartment sourcing stuff, right? So Alibaba is one way to find manufacturers. Again, you know, when you know your product, it's very easy to look for similar products and similar things, and have those initial conversations. Canton Fair is one of my favorite places to go to find manufacturers, to talk to manufacturers. You can hold the samples in your hand. You can cut down that sourcing time from months of going back and forth into like weeks or less, right? You can go do factory visits while you're there. So I love Canton Fair. And then 1688 is great, just because there's more suppliers there. Of course, sourcing companies, sourcing agents, people who are already in China can kind of help you with that. They can find factories that you might not find, because there's a lot that are not at Canton Fair. There's a lot that are not on Alibaba. There's, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. So you can use a combination of those things, but I generally like to source in person if possible, and make sure that I'm vetting the factories no matter where I find them.
Right. That's yeah. If you can go to Canton, that's great. I know a lot of people go back and forth on Iwu, but Canton is probably your best bet. And we had Maglon a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about, you know, even looking at sourcing in India and the fairs that they have there. So there's so many other ways of just exploring. Now, don't forget about Google. You know, Google, you might be able to, just like you're doing, Amy, you might be able to find some really great manufacturers in the good old US of A. And why not? You know, and I hope you agree with me on this one. It's a selling feature. I don't know about you, but if I see something made in Canada, made in the USA, I'm willing to pay a little bit more for it. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think there's many times people just assume that it's going to be more expensive in the US. But my product would have actually been more expensive in China because it's large. So it makes more sense to do it in the US. So I think you should source from wherever. Import records, Norm, that's the other one we forgot to mention.
Oh, yeah.
You can, import records are public. So yep. You can use sites like Panjiva to actually search your competitors' suppliers' names, because import records are public. So that's another way to find out what you could look at a major brand and see who their supplier is. And then, of course, Google is your friend after that, and doing some more research.
Yeah, in Canada, we have something called RN numbers, and the government has a database. So if you look at a Canadian made, let's say a t-shirt, and you see the RN number, you just go to the Canadian RN database and it'll tell you exactly who it is. So yeah, that's another, there's so many different opportunities. One of the companies or the sourcing platforms that I just want to talk about briefly is that there's a lot of hype about 1688, and 1688 is owned by Alibaba. And for the average person, it's great to source there, but sometimes you got to be very careful because, first of all, you don't speak Chinese. The 1688 is also set up for more of what it's set up for the Chinese community and not the North American or European community. So what they publish, get this, I don't know if you know this, I'm sure you do, but what they publish and what they show doesn't have to meet the quality standards. So they might show you something, and this also is reflected in the price. If you dig a little deeper into the site, you'll notice that the site, the prices published on the site are just a price. That's it. They don't have to stick by the price. It's just a price. Also, certification. You're not going to get certification because they won't provide it. And a lot of them, most of them, don't have export licenses. But if you want to go and check them out on Alibaba if you can get the supplier name. So there's a lot of different things on 1688. It's great for ideas. But I just wanted to point that out because so many people talk about it. You're experienced, so you can go in there and kind of work through it and, you know, make sure that these people are real, like you said. But it really is a site for Chinese. And I know, I don't know if Tim Chin is listening, but, you know, he always says, oh, well, I use 1688. Well, you're Chinese and you can read everything. mean, but anyways.
Yeah, you can use the same, you know, if you find a supplier on 1688, Google Translate automatically translates it. I have a process where I click inside of their kind of store on 1688, and then I'll go and look at that supplier's name, their history. And then of course I take that off of 1688 and go see where else I can find them and run it through my vetting process. So that, yeah, I recently, with this new product that I just developed, I sourced a stock product from 1688, had that sent over to my other factory that was going to manually make that product and was going to cost me a lot more money. So I found a stock product that's similar in another category. And I was able to send that over to my supplier, order, you know, 2,000 of them, send them over to my supplier. And then they were able to use those, and they only developed the thing that they were really good at developing. And I actually had that factory purchase those from that supplier in China so that I didn't have to worry about, you know, paying twice for, you know, the taxes and everything else there. And then they're better at communicating. They're Chinese, obviously, so they're better at communicating with that other supplier. So that's the thing. If you're going to use multiple factories, multiple suppliers, make sure that you're, as much as possible, sticking with a lead supplier, right? Having one supplier put everything together, because when you think about the contracts that you are entering into with those suppliers, you really, you can't, if that's like, if you're using a trading company to develop a unique product, a trading company is going out and just sourcing that from a factory. So they're not going to be held accountable when that factory goes and sells your design to somebody else, right? Because they're not the ones manufacturing the product. So it's really important that you know who your supplier is, you know where your product is being manufactured, you know how it's being manufactured, and that those contracts properly protect you. So just some things to think about there.
Right. So Kels, any more questions? I'm seeing a few things come down.
Just got three. So I'll just quickly run through them. First off, from Simon, what is the Import Report website called?
There's one called Panjiva. There's a bunch of different ones. You can like just Google like import records, you know, search import records.
Yeah. And also I think, I know, I don't subscribe to it, but Jungle Scout.
Oh yeah. Jungle Scout has one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's fairly inexpensive. Panjiva is a, you can kind of, well, I shouldn't even say.
There's this, like a couple of like free searches on it that you can get a little bit of information. But yeah, you after that, they want you to pay a lot. So you kind of just have to play around with different ones. But yeah, Jungle Scout has one.
I think
Zonguru has one as well. I think. Yeah.
So it's your first born child on Panjiva after that. But anyways, the one on Jungle Scout is.
That's Hayden. That's not me.
Yeah, that's Hayden. There we go. Yeah. But Jungle Scout's is affordable for that. And you might just ask your ask a broker or your sourcing agent to dig into it, and they can dig into it easily.
Okay. And Rhea is saying hi, Amy.
Hello, Rhea.
And we have, let's see, we have three more. Okay. First off, Yarrow. Any general suggestions on selling kids' toys?
Well, that's kind of a broad question. General suggestions on selling kids' toys? Know your market and know your competition. Those are my general suggestions.
Check out the cost of certification. Yeah, that could be pretty costly too. I know one of my clients, Amazon just nailed them on getting certified, and it's going to cost them, I think it was $20,000. So just make sure that when you enter into, and I mean, babe or toys are so general, but in this specific category of toys, that they had to get a certain certification that was going to be about $20,000.
Yeah, and Simon's saying if you're using more than one factory, make sure each has a golden sample to ensure consistency.
Oh yeah, sign off, right, Amy? Get that. Yeah. Get the production sample signed off.
Yeah.
We are about we're over an hour actually.
Are we over an hour?
Yeah. So maybe after these two questions, then we can start closing it up. But Victor, do you agree that a posted price on 1688? Is in general closer to actual than one on Alibaba?
I never go off the prices on any of those websites. On a recent negotiation I did with a client, the posted price on Alibaba was $5, and we left the negotiation at $1.27 a unit. So, yeah, again, know your manufacturing process. Know your supplier, know your raw material costs, be able to communicate those things. And it's okay to check prices just in general, but I don't know what you think about that, Norm, but
a guide.
It's a guide. Yes. Yeah. It's one data point. It's like you never want to use product research software as your only data point. You want to know why people are buying that product. If they're buying a whole bunch of it, why are they buying it, right? Where else is that competitor at? It's the same thing on pricing, like potential pricing when you're running your numbers before deciding on moving forward with a product. It's just one data point. But the most important thing to know is what your target price is. Because that will determine whether or not you ultimately can move forward with the product and if it can be profitable for you.
Another thing to think about, Victor, is if you're using that as a base and you can take that $5 and you can use like a 3 or 4 times multiple and still, still make it on Amazon. So if the average cost, let's say, is $20 or, $24, then you've got a ton of room in there. And if you get anything down to $3 or like Amy said, a buck something, man, you're going to kill it on Amazon. But if you use that as the base And you can still compete with that $5 base, knowing that you can even come, you know, 50% of that. Then, you know, you'll be very happy.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately you need to make money. Your factory needs to make, it's a partnership. Yeah. You know, it's not about like killing your factory. Oh yeah. You need them to be happy as well and making money. But a lot of people forget that they also need to make money. So, you know, they don't do that negotiation. They kind of have that pen pal relationship with that. Marina had a question about how does she know if she's dealing with a manufacturer or trading agent? And again, Marina, that comes down to vetting your supplier. So ask them for their business license. That's when you go to Canton Fair, their business license is proudly displayed. Like, that's not something that you should be shy about asking them. But ask for their business license, check them out, make sure they are who they say they are, because a lot of them will tell you that we're both a trading company and a factory. And sometimes it's true, but a lot of times it's not. So you can do a factory audit. You can use any of the inspection companies. They'll do a factory audit for you to make sure they are who they say they are. And those factory audits are really, really thorough.
Yeah, and a broker's not a horrible thing. Depending on what you're, there's so many layers of brokers, but a lot of the times, if you've got a company that is backwoods China and they're producing a good product, they don't speak English, they don't have an export license, so they depend on a broker to do that for them. So it's not awful to have a broker, and probably the high majority of the time when you see that, there is a broker involved. Even though you're dealing with the factory, the broker is working with you to deal with the factory in China, because most of them are Chinese, you know, and I'm talking about speaking Chinese, and they need that person and they need the export license.
And we got one more question. And if anyone else does have questions, if you can please just post them in the Facebook group. I'm going to be making a thread of the past episodes, the three episodes this week. So any questions you've had from Shane Oglo, Daryl Patterson, or Amy today, you can post them there. And anyone from the community or Norm, I know Amy, you're part of the group, but if you ever see anything that you can answer, like, feel free to put in your comments. But Elchin, last question is, when defining target price, what is your minimum ROI generally?
Well, this is where I'm a little different than most courses and programs. I aim for a minimum 7x multiplier.
Beautiful.
That means that if I source it for $1, I need to be able to sell it for 10. If I source it for $10, I need to be able to sell it for 70. Now on Amazon, I like to have a minimum 10x multiplier. And a lot of people think this is impossible. It is impossible if you're selling a commodity product that a bunch of other Amazon sellers are selling and all of you are paying way too much from the supplier because you never negotiated or anything. The suppliers are not going to drop their price because all of you are paying them way too much money. So it just, and then you're competing with factories on Amazon, right? But when it comes to developing a product and developing a relationship with the factory, Amazon's fees are actually 7x is the gold standard in retail. To be able to sell your product at wholesale prices beyond Amazon, you need that margin, right? Because you're splitting it on both sides. Because you're, in general, you're selling your product for half of retail at wholesale pricing, right? So you want to have the margin to grow your company and do that. But on Amazon, you're paying advertising. When you're doing direct to consumer, you're paying for advertising. You're paying for a lot more in terms of shipping and fulfillment fees and referral fees and everything else. So on Amazon, I like to have a 10x multiplier. But a lot of people think it's impossible, and it is not impossible. Everybody in my program is getting those kinds of numbers. And the only time they don't get those kinds of numbers, and this is when it's okay to not get those kinds of numbers, is if you're sourcing a minimum viable product, you're testing it out, you're going to pay a little more to a manufacturer to give you 100 units.
Right.
you know, it's not worth their time. You're going to pay a little more. You're going to be lucky if you break even. That's okay. I want you to spend the time to negotiate ahead of time and make sure, not if, because you're going to do all your market research. You're going to make sure that this is going to be a great product for you to move forward with. But when you grow, there's still a good partner for you. So I always negotiate at a full container at a time because I want to understand, can you grow with me? When I'm ready to make larger orders with this product, because I know where I've gone, I've already done the research, right? When I'm ready for those larger orders, are you going to meet my target price? Are you going to be where I need to be? And so I negotiate all of that up front. And then I come back and make sure that at 100 units, at that first test order of 1,000 units or whatever, when I'm doing an MVP, I'm willing to pay a little surcharge there. Often I can get that surcharge credited back to me on the next order.
You know what? We've never talked about that. And that is exactly what I do. I'm looking for 10 yes. times. And I also credit back exactly what you just said. So we're thinking along the 100% the same. If you can't do 10 times, then you can rethink it. Now, when I was talking about like the 3 to 4 times, I mean, that's if you can get 3 to 4 times, you'll make money on Amazon. If you can 10x it, oh my gosh.
You're going to crush your competitors too.
Yeah.
Because you have margin and yeah. they don't, you know, it's just, it's crazy. And you're going to be able to turn over your inventory so much faster. Think about it, you guys, when you have enough net profit left over to buy 3 or 4 more units, you can turn your inventory so fast and you can scale your business so fast. It's really awesome.
Right. And if you can't quite get there, so let's say that you're at 7 times, you know what I'm going to say.
Perceived I don't know.
Value, packaging for pennies. You can turn that 7 times into 10 times. So that's really important as well. And where do you get your packaging from? You can get that in China as well. So,
yes.
And yeah. And usually the manufacturer will kit for very little if they're not kitting for you already, but they'll put the kitting and assembly together most of the time, pennies or free. They want the business.
Yes, definitely. It's awesome.
So, all right. So I think that's probably wrapping it up for the questions here. Amy, before we came on, I said, look, is there anything that we can do for anybody that's listening live? And you had a great idea. Can you share that?
Yeah. So
not everybody, by the way, not everybody, but what can you do for us?
Well, you guys, I do this thing. I don't really publicize it very much, but if you have a product and you're not sure how your listing looks or why it's not selling or what advertising strategies you should use, you can actually submit it to me and I will create a video for you telling you exactly what I would do. I have hundreds of page one listings in every category across Amazon. Not my own listings, but listings I've written for other people and brands that I've helped. So you can submit your listing to me at amazingathome.com/listing-review. And I will create a video for you. And you can put in the form right there exactly what your problem is. Like, Amy, I don't know, should I use a different PPC strategy? I'm not getting as many sales conversions. I don't know what's going on. And I'll take a good look at it for you and give you a review.
Okay, so one lucky listener is going to get that. And all you have to do is type, get ready, guys. Amy is awesome. There we go. First person in gets it. So the other thing I want to talk about too, you've got an amazing course. And again, no affiliates, nothing to do with it. Amy, if you want to talk a little bit about your course, please do so.
Well, I was so excited, Norm, to my course won 3rd place in the seller poll. I mean, I was absolutely blown away by that. I don't really do any marketing. So, you know, it's all word of mouth. But I have a course called Concept to Launch. And what we do is we take you all the way from concept to launch. We teach you how to negotiate. We teach you how to find suppliers. We give you all the worksheets along the way. I was an instructor in the military for 18 years. So I have a really awesome capability to take hard concepts and break them down into easy to understand things. So we have four different modules. We teach you from, honestly, from concept all the way to launching on Amazon and beyond, getting your website set up, writing your listing, becoming a master of listing optimization, all of that. But the really cool part is we cover product development, prototyping, finding a manufacturer, sourcing, negotiation, all of that. That's the stuff that is not covered in depth. And that's the stuff that's going to help you beat your competitors, right? So that's at amazingathome.com. You guys can always check it out. And it's something that I just love to do. I love helping people bring cool products to the market.
Very good. So we do have a winner. We have a bunch of people, but Yaroslav. Okay. So Yaro, get your information over to Kelsey. So that's K at Lunch with Norm. He'll put it in the comment section and we'll make sure that you get that all set up with Amy.
Okay. Thanks, Yaro.
Yeah.
For being the first to say I'm awesome. I appreciate it.
And thanks you everybody else that, you know, joined in. Darren, you were close. Elchin, let's see. Golem, thank you. Simon, Marina. Marina. Amy is awesome as well. Yes, very good. Hey, thank you for building this community, everybody. This is awesome. Yes. Amy, thank you. People, how do they reach you?
You guys can go to amazingathome.com. You can find me on Facebook, and we have a Facebook community called Amazing at Home. So check us out. We're around. And thank
you,
Norm, so much.
And you're part of our community, too. So that's
absolutely. Yes. Yep. If you guys have any follow-up questions or anything like that, I'm yes. Yes. All right. Who would not be part of, like, this is all backwards, Norm's community?
We're just happy to have you. All right. So thank you so much for being on. I mean, you're just a wealth of knowledge. We got to have you back on again. Just thank you. Appreciate your time. And look, everything that you're doing with this side of the business is usually not talked about. So it's so important that people know that they're leaving so much money on the table and how to be different. And that's what really drives sales. So anyways, Amy, thank you for being on, and we will talk to you soon, hopefully at an event.
Yeah. Oh, I miss you, Norm. And I miss everybody else out there too. Thanks again for having me on.
You're very welcome. Okay, everybody. So I'm about to cough just a sec. I knew it was going to sneak up on me. Anyways, fantastic. I really enjoyed the podcast and speaking with Amy today. Learned a little bit myself. Anyways, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. And again, if you have any questions, just throw them into the comment section. We will get back to them. So Kelsey, where are you?
Instead of putting them in the comment section, put them in the Facebook group.
I'll put the
discussion post. You can put them all in there. So it's all in one place. It'll take me maybe about like 10 minutes afterwards to put it together. But yeah, please and thanks. And Simon, thank you for noticing my vampire bites on the side of my neck.
I didn't see them. Where?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. All right. Very good.
Yeah. But yes, if you haven't already, please join the group. I know there's already a bunch of you. I think we're definitely over 100. I think we're around like 135 members.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a growing community. Started just 3 weeks ago, so it's really awesome to see all the growth that's happening and in the discussions too. Let me see. We have Golem. All the best, dear Norm. Thank you for coming on.
You are welcome, sir.
But yeah, follow us on social media. Our Facebook group is Lunch with Norm, Amazon FBA, and E-commerce Collective. If you want to listen to us on podcasts, you can find us on Apple and Spotify. Anywhere you find you listen to your podcast, you can find Lunch with Norm. And yeah, I think that's about it. If you haven't already, please like and share. And I think that's it for me.
Smash.
And smash that like button. ring that bell. And it's great to see you guys all joining us. Who's coming on next week?
Oh, so next week, Vinny Fisher is going to, I think he's the first person that's going to be on. And Vinny's going to be discussing hybrid work models and how companies are adjusting with the new norms, no pun intended, of 2020. So that should be a great episode as well. The other thing is we've got a newsletter. It does not suck. All sorts of content. We've got videos, blog articles, curated articles, everything to help the online sellers sell. So if you want to check that out, you can find that on Lunch with Norm, or you can go over to normanferrar.com and just subscribe. It comes out every Monday. And I think on that note, sir, we're done.
Yeah, we, along with Vinny, we also have, a big week. We have Cassandra. She's going to be on to talk about some social media tips about influencers and content creators. So I think that's really important for Amazon and e-commerce sellers.
Kevin's on too, isn't he?
And Kevin King is on. So our monthly Talk and Shop Q&A. So
perfect.
That's on Friday. So the events are all there. You can sign up already on the Facebook page. And yeah.
Okay. So thank you, Kels. So everybody, tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at noon Eastern Standard Time. And thank you again for watching, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Halloween.
Entrepreneur. Entrepreneur.